See if we can get through a couple sentences before we finish.
Well, I'm just especially interested in this part because, you know, for our own purposes as people who are studying this and thinking about it, you know, thinking about how these two principles work inside us. And here he's really talking about the mechanics of the way these two principles work together. And that I find that rather fascinating because I can look into my own life and say, well, you know, how are the images working with my desires and my pleasures? And, you know, how is that engine... How does that engine work exactly? If I take my own life and I look at the specific instances, mm-hmm. I think it's important. And then to put that in terms of dream work, mm-hmm. too.
I think it's terribly important. And we're now looking at the foundation of Jungian psychology. This is exactly what's going on. Because you know he will never separate mind and body, and he honors the lowest form of experience as our starting points.
Gary, are you recording now?
Yeah.
Did you turn it on? Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
One word. So let's see. Where are we?
Forethinking.
We got forethinking and thought. We got pleasure as force. We got pleasure destroying forms.
Forethinking means pleasure. This is a very important thing too.
Forethinking means pleasure, exactly. To be able to come to form.
Pleasure means forethinking to come to form, which
it requires. Right. And then look at the footnote 70. Therefore, the forethinker approached me as Elijah, the prophet, and pleasure as Solomon. Now, this is highly intuitive thinking, and I think we've got the most of it, but let's see what else we can pluck out of this. If pleasure lacked forming, pleasure would dissolve into manifoldness and become splintered. You understand pleasure and forming. That ironic, this is what he later said, that there's a logos in instinct. That instinct and desire really has an intelligence built into it. We think of it as purely biological, but that is way inadequate. In other words, your eros will often lead you to just the right person for your next step.
You said that is equal to the idea there's a logos?
In instinct, yeah.
Instinct.
Yeah, in other words, instinct, if you follow it, will lead you to the self. If you follow it consciously.
And we've always been agreed.
Yeah, and said it's just chaos. But it's not, if you know how to work with it.
But before Jung, we did not know how to work with it.
Right. Okay. And I certainly, before Jung, in the sense of in psychoanalysis, see, for Freud, instinct has to be controlled. It's just chaos. And Jung is saying, no, instinct's got its own brain.
Also connected to spirit.
Which is spirit.
Okay.
Yeah, so instinct and spirit exist together.
And it seems like they produce the forethinking.
Which is the foundation of forethinking.
Or that logos in instinct is forethinking.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Absolutely.
It is. What is he says up here somewhere? It's a both and. Maybe it's the next page. Anyway,
yeah, first he says it's side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And later he says it's both and. Well, again, highly intuitive, and I don't think he's seeing anything new now. He's just restating what we've already heard. If a form does not contain, see where I am? If a form does not contain any compressed pleasure within itself, it cannot reach the higher, since it always flows like water from above to below.
Now, is he talking about the form involved in forethinking or the form involved in... He must be talking about forethinking.
Yes.
To contain the compressed pleasure.
Right. In other words, just as pleasure can lead to thought, it is the nature of thought to engender the erotic situation to bring itself into being. That's the logos of instinct. Does that make sense?
But that it could, and then the logos of instinct equals forethought.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's just kind of saying, oh, look how Salome and Elijah are related. All pleasure, when left alone, flows into the deep sea and ends in the deathly stillness of dispersal into unending space. But see, he's not leading pleasure alone. He's working with it. So it doesn't lead to unending space.
So that would be if, say, you were attracted to something, an addiction, you just kept fulfilling it.
Exactly. And never stopped and said, what is the meaning of this?
For me, that's the firefish in the painting, the compression and containing of pleasure.
Yeah, the below would be the pleasure, and the above would be forethought.
Forethought.
Yeah.
But that bit of pleasure contained in the forethought is the firefish.
Right. And the logos contained in the fire is the lower fish.
Or the smoke. Or
what do you call it, smoke fish?
I don't. I guess you could say they're smoke or air, I guess.
Air fish.
You might say.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So how then would Jung respond to a critic who would say, you know, really you're saying this to justify the fact that you're doing something that is unacceptable in our society or immoral or any negative words they want to attach to it? I know very little about his life, and I'm grappling with the things that he said and how his relationship with Tony Wolf is okay in these particular circumstances. So I'm trying to understand, you know, how would Jung have responded if somebody said, you know, yeah, this sounds great, but really you're just using that as justification to do something that's wrong. How would he respond to that, or how would you respond as an analyst to those kinds of statements?
Well, I think the answer is, what is the long-term effect of all of this?
Okay.
The long-term effect was 40 volumes.
But when you're in it, you can't know, right? I mean, there was no way for him to know that.
I think the fact that Elijah is here is as clear as it's going to get.
Okay.
That there was a wisdom involved.
And Jung knew that. He understood that there was a wisdom.
I think that was his leap of faith, that what other alternative was there? Let's try this.
I know myself to be a moral person. I find myself in the situation that is by my culture's definition immoral, and because I continue to engage in it, there has to be some deeper meaning, or I would not allow that to happen. Is that a fair statement?
No, I don't think he was that advanced.
Okay.
I think his thing was, what else is there for me to do?
Because it was so vital.
Well, I think he must have felt this sense, you know, there's got to be more to psychology than what Freud has come up with. I think that he felt strongly. And I don't know what it is, but I sure do feel a pressure to seek out the answer. I think that would have been his experience. And the other thing, too, is he was honest about it.
Right.
I think that's a very important factor. And everybody agreed. I don't know if everybody liked it. They agreed. Pleasure is not older than forethinking, and forethinking is not older than pleasure. Again, trying to get top of the second column on 247. Just that these two work together. Both are equally old and in nature intimately one. That's what we've been trying to get across. Only in man does the separate existence of both principles become apparent.
So when Tony came on the scene, then did he remain sexually active with his wife as well?
Oh, yeah.
Even though it was, I mean, just as a woman, to be told that my sex is unimaginative would sort of...
I don't think he ever said... I don't think he ever said your sex is unimaginative.
But that's how he felt, right?
I don't think he felt her sex was unimaginative. I think he felt that she couldn't help him create this thing he was trying to create. I think she would have agreed she couldn't help him create the thing.
Which is why she allowed the situation.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
And it's true. Your euros are not hung up like we are on this stuff.
No, that's very true.
I think I told you my French teacher said that our Mitterrand, you know, the past president, had two families. Both of them lived in the Champs-Élysées. He and his wife and kids lived on one floor, and his mistress and kids by her lived on the second floor. And nobody thought, you know, about doing a Bill Clinton on him. So, okay, so we got Elijah and Salome.
Do we?
More or less. We'll come back because this continues. But now he wants to talk about the serpent. Apart from Elijah and Salome, I found the serpent as a third principle. It is a stranger to both principles, although it is associated with both. The serpent taught me the unconditional difference in essence between the two principles in me. If I look, well, should we just stop there?
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. We're going to see eventually, it might help to reach the conclusion before we get there. Go down to the bottom of the second column on 247 and go up 1, 2, 3 paragraphs. The first line, the way of life. Rise like the serpent, from right to left, and from left to right. So, the serpent would be the way of life.
Could we equate the serpent with the Tao? He seems to be talking about it.
I think we could.
And of course, in the beginning, the Tao was thought of as a serpent.
That's right.
And later in the philosophy of Taoism, that was sort of put aside.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning.
So we think of the Tao as a straight line, at least I do.
Well, I think of that the path that the swimmer is on is the path of Tao.
It's a little optimistic. Because
to stay on it.
Well, that it's straight.
Well, not very straight at all if you look at it, but it's undulating.
Okay. Well, then you're safe. Well,
it's just a path, I guess.
But it's an undulating path, I think, is what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As I always say, the shortest distance between two points is a detour.
Could we call it a unifying symbol in that it brings the two together?
Yes.
The understanding of the two together?
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I'm anticipating here. What he's getting at is that these two figures, Salome and Elijah, are two sides of the life process. We've kind of said the same thing in different words. Creative life process. Right. I'm a little puzzled. It is a stranger to both principles, although it is associated with both.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he means that without consciousness, the two don't relate themselves to each other. That may be what he's driving at. I don't know. The serpent taught me the unconditional difference in essence between the two principles in me. And again, I think that's early thinking. And pretty soon he's going to say they're the same thing.
He already has, though. It up here, right?
Well, he says it more directly. Where does he say it?
Oh, he says only in man do they appear separate. They're both ultimately one.
Yeah. Okay. But look, we'll get there. Hold on to that thought. We may not get there today. If I look across, again, we got the main idea. This is all just extrapolating. If I look across from forethinking to pleasure, I see the deterrent poisonous serpent. Follow that. That what his eros is leading him into is a mess. If I look from pleasure to forethinking, likewise, I feel the cold, cruel serpent. I think by that he means that really what pleasure wants ultimately is for you to get out of pleasure and into meaning.
Right, he hasn't found that third yet.
He's still on either side.
Too much in the opposite.
Right. The serpent is the earthly essence of man, of which he is not conscious.
Can I ask a question about that? Because pleasure, I think, you go from pleasure to meaning, but it seems to me that it's kind of meaning to pleasure, pleasure to meaning. It's that same thing as just went through, that when you're creating something, it often will give you an aha or something which is pleasurable, which takes you to meaning, which takes you to pleasure again, and then more meaning.
Well, I think you mean sexual pleasure.
Oh, okay. Erotic or sexual?
Erotic.
Are you using the word as the same thing?
Yeah. For us mere mortals, your Saint Teresa may be different, but the earthly Numen Loki, that's the spirit of the place. So, now, some of this gets really convoluted. And as I say, we got the main idea. So, separates forethinking and pleasure in man, but not in itself. The serpent has the weight of the earth in itself, but also its changeability and germination, from which everything that becomes emerges. So, I think the serpent as life, he's just saying this is what life is. It's being led into the balance between eros and creation. It is always the serpent that causes man to become enslaved now to one, now to the other principle. so that it becomes error. I'm not sure why he says it's the
serpent. Yeah, that's puzzling.
Yeah. Unless he's saying, again, that it's distinguishing between the life process and consciousness of a life process. That the life process, in and of itself, doesn't do anything to help you balance the opposites. It's the nature of life to throw you this way or to throw you that way. And we got to say, whoa, I want them together. One cannot live with forethinking alone or pleasure alone. You need both. Now, 3 pages from now, he's going to absolutely contradict this sentence. But you cannot be in forethinking and in pleasure at the same time. You must take turns being in forethinking and pleasure, obeying the prevailing law and faithful to the other, so to speak. Look on 250. He says, look at the first column, second paragraph, second sentence. If, where I am, if forethinking and pleasure united me, a third arises from them, and so on. So, you know, he is, remember, we're listening to the unconscious here. And it doesn't mind contradicting itself.
I thought he was talking in this paragraph about what things were like on the earth now, that we separate forethinking and pleasure, we compartmentalize those things. And then later he was saying what was trying to happen in him. That's where I went with it.
I thought he was saying, this is kind of where I am now. I can do one or the other, but I can't do both.
Okay.
And then later down the road, he's going to say, whoa, but I got to try to get the two together. Yeah. And then the rest of that paragraph on 247, he's just saying, generally, people do one or the other. Either they go with their pleasure and they forget about thinking, and they go with their thinking and they forget about work. As I said, then the way of life lies like the serpent. And then that last sentence of that paragraph, thus the serpent is an adversary and a symbol of enmity, but also a wise bridge that connects right and left through longing, much needed by our life. It's an adversary if we don't accept what it's asking, or if we accept it, it can guide us. That is, if we pay attention to our eros and interpret it, it can guide us. And I think Elijah and Solomon live in a dark and a bright space. That should be clear, right? The dark is the blindness of desire. The bright is the possibility of reflection. This next part's a little hard too. Eve and the serpent, show me that my next step leads to pleasure. That's where I thought it was about, Tony. His next step is to deal with this relationship. And from there again, on lengthy wanderings like Odysseus. Need to look at Odysseus. I think there were three main generals in the Odyssey. I should back up. The story of the Trojan War started with the Iliad. There were three main generals: Odysseus, Menelaus, and who's the other? Agamemnon. They couldn't set sail because there was no wind. The oracle said, Agamemnon, you have to sacrifice your daughter and you'll get the wind. He did. His wife was not particularly happy about it. They went, they fought the war, a bunch of guys got killed. These three guys survived. Agamemnon came back and his wife killed him for having murdered their daughter. Menelaus came back to a very boring suburban life. Agamemnon, Odysseus is the only one that came back to real love. And his journey back is the Odyssey. I have thought that the Odyssey then is a record of what he had to do to give penance for the murder of his daughter. So that his journey is a restitution of the feminine. Does that make sense? Agamemnon's story. But they were all party to the guilt of killing this girl to be able to fight the battle. That's according to Sparks. I thought so. Agamemnon paid for it with his life. Menelaus paid for it with boredom. And he's the only one that made a conscious whose journey can be seen as a restitution of the feminine, because he has to deal with all those feminine figures on the way back. Actually, it is kind of a rotten journey because he has to deal with all these witches. And another reason I think that there might be something what I'm saying, he finally comes to a woman that he really wants and he can't have her. And he accepts that. And she then gives him the ship to finish his journey. Nausicaa. So I say that because Jung is equating himself here to Odysseus, which I think means a journey to restore the feminine to its rightful place. Because in our work, we try to follow as much as we try to lead. We try to follow the inner process. And that, to me, is the restitution of the feminine.
His feminine?
The analytic process is about the feminine way of hearing and following versus actively doing. Have a good trip. That's devotion. Studying up to the last minute. Hi. Hi. Yeah, so that the feminine is this idea of following the unconscious rather than trying to control it.
Okay. So Say that again? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm equating Jung to Odysseus here, and what Odysseus did was serve the feminine, and how I think what Odysseus did was restore the feminine. And what Jung is doing is restoring the feminine insofar as Jungian analysis tries to follow the spirit rather than simply create an ego-based life. And that following is the feminine. So another way, what you could say, what we're dealing with here is Jung is learning to follow the meaning of his eros.
What was Odysseus' trip to Troy?
I don't remember the exact...
You mean the course?
It might have been... I don't remember the exact... I've never been able to read the Iliad.
Didn't he do the Trojan horse?
He might have been behind a Trojan horse. Okay. I don't remember. But I think his biggest sin, the whole sin of that war party was killing the girl, which I would understand is that story shows that the patriarchal attitude toward life kills the feminine. And that's just what was getting established culturally as the Indo-Europeans, you know, moved into the Greek geographical area. And but the story itself beautifully shows not only the death of the feminine, but the restitution of the feminine. So in that sense, it's incredibly modern. Well, okay, 248, my God, we've got another page. The first two paragraphs, I think we've done. Thinking, blindness, etc. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I brought up Neumann on my mind again. The second end of the second paragraph.
Oh, I was just going to
go ahead.
Do the first sentence there.
Okay, go ahead.
A thinker should fear Salome since she wants his head. That, by now, should be clear that losing the head means you give up your forethinking because you're obsessed with passion, pleasure, eroticism. So that's how Salome chops off our heads. A thinker cannot be a holy person, otherwise he loses his head. Because if you only think, you've left out the entire problem of eros.
So now we're sort of transitioning over into our conscious thinking.
Right. It does not help to hide oneself in thought. Therefore, solidification overtakes you. Rigidity. Is that what you were...
No,
it's the last one?
The next one.
Let's read it, Samuel.
You must turn back motherly forethought to obtain renewal, for forethought leads to song. And where my mind went with that was Neumann, that's where a man starts his development, is separating from the mother.
Oh.
And which leads to the desire of a feminine outside that. Where is that on? It's at the end of that paragraph. A thinker paragraph. A thinker
on 251.
248. You're way ahead of us. Well, if you put out Neumann's terms, Sandy, I think he's talking about somebody who's already separated from mother.
Yes. Right?
And motherly forethought, in a way, it is getting back to the unconscious.
And I was even thinking about Emma as the continuation of the mother, and then he meets Tony.
I think it's more subtle than people as mother. Uh-huh. It's more motherly as the origin of our mind. Motherly. What did he say? Motherly.
Forethought.
Yeah. It's the thinking in pictures, which is closer to the unconscious than direct thinking.
So the ability of the unconscious to birth forth images,
Right. And it is true, the more a person has a positive mother complex, the easier this is. I don't think they're talking about mother complexes, they're just talking about the imagination being close to the unconscious as source. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You see that with people with horrendous negative mother complexes. They can't imagine. It's like the mind is like there's molasses up there. Not very often, because they probably wouldn't be attracted to Jung anyway. But from time to time. It's like, you know, passing the butter and then they throw it. You know, everything is literalized. Well, I think the next paragraph, too, is just explicating how, if you're in one position, the other seems hostile. If you're in the other position, the former seems hostile. And the danger of giving yourself over to either one is rigidity, and the other is emotional disaster.
When he's talking of feeling here, is he speaking of it in the sense that he ultimately uses it in the four functions?
Where is that?
Well, the thinker's passions are bad, therefore he has no pleasure. Thoughts of one who feels are bad, therefore he has no thoughts.
I think he's using it in the earlier common way. Feeling almost meaning emotion. Feeling meaning having emotion.
But it would work both ways, I guess. It would also work for his ultimate definition of feeling as valuing.
Yeah, a valuing that comes out of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we could think of it both ways at this point?
You could. I think he was thinking of it as feelings.
I see. Okay.
Like Barry Manilow or something.
Okay. Emotion.
Yeah.
Well, he, down in the footnote, said the correct address said pleasure.
Oh. That defines it a bit.
Yeah.
Three times he mentions feeling.
It's an area of pleasure.
Yeah.
I think that pretty much does that column. The last paragraph, Elijah said you should recognize her through love.
I like the end of the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph where he said, so the serpent lies between the thinker and the one who feels. They are each other's poison and healing. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
kind of goes back to the initial flowers that were close to
us. Right.
I like the way he lays out the thoughts of one who is feeling and then the feelings of one who is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really rings true.
So he's saying that because he was somebody who was pretty steeped in thought,
right,
the answer came to him as through eros. But if he had been somebody who was living his eros, then it would have come to him through thought.
Well, kind of, but I believe what he's trying to get across is that these two always work together. And as a thinker, this entire process of imagining and feeling came to him through feeling. If he'd been a pleasure-based person, this process of pleasure and creation would have come to him through the pole of imagination.
I'm gonna try it. This is hard.
I know, it's really hard. Okay, the absolute crudest. If a man is the thinker, he's probably going to be drawn to a woman for her body. If a man is a Casanova, he will be the woman that really makes an impact on him will be the one who he's drawn to for her mind. That's putting it very crudely. But what I think he's more saying more gently is these two, the imaginative, creative imaginative, and the physical, they work together, and all of us lean one side to one side or the other, and whatever side you're leaning on, you're probably going to get wackoed by somebody who's leaning on the other side.
Because you always see really handsome men with really ugly women, and you wonder how they got them, but they're always really smart. Haven't you noticed that? Like, in the no, I agree. So, like, the best-looking guys always have, like, the, you know, really homely... Not always, but, you know, they...
But really what he's trying to get at, and what he's done these last really almost two pages after that first two really tough paragraphs, he's just explicating that idea of how these two work together. And yeah, it's nice to talk about them being a synthesis, but generally we get hit by one side or the other. And then we got to work to establish the balance. Life has a tendency to throw us into the situation where we have to develop just the opposite side. That's the snake.
So, Gary, Jung's work was about the redemption of the feminine, but as a woman going through analysis, you're trying to regain your masculine side. But the societal element is still the patriarchy trying to redeem the feminine.
Yeah, because the way we try to redeem it is through following what it wants rather than laying down active principles.
But wouldn't analysis also for a woman be bringing her into relationship with her true feminine nature and not what's defined by our patriarchal culture?
Right.
It is redeeming the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And bringing her in relationship with the masculine.
Well, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're working on your masculine or feminine, the basic methodology, at least for people, you know, who aren't youngsters, where you're talking about ego development, assuming you've got some ego stability, is by hearing the message of the dream. That's a feminine activity, taking it in.
So in this example, then my grandmother's one of eight, and seven of her of the girls in her family married hellions. They grew up very religious, evangelical, tongue-speaking, repressed, and seven out of eight of them married maniacs. A couple of them married more than one maniac. You know, like hard drinking, cussing, swearing, philandering, and yet, with the exception of the couple who had more than one, they all sort of stayed with this person all the way through to the end. And it seemed like so. But there was a balance because they brought fun, and the other person brought stability or solidity, or you know. So psychologically, that's what he's talking about, right? That sort of as a metaphor for the balance that you get, and why you have these strange attractions that shouldn't match.
And the goal, of course, is to get them both inside yourself, so that you're free to make a choice, which is not a reaction.
But it always starts as a reaction. And so it's sort of alchemical, right? I mean, you put two light things, two alkaline things or acidic things, nothing happens. But you mix them, you get something new.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. Thank you. I can do my summer now because I finally have it. I can leave today.
Well, that takes us up to instruction, and I'm not even going to think about starting, because it's another whammy. But we will go through that as slowly as we've gone through this, because the first part of instruction, 248, 249, is more of this continued dialogue. It continues in this section, and it continues even in the next section. So I was probably a little optimistic in having you read to 252. But how far did you read? 252, wasn't it?
No, 255.
I was probably a little optimistic. Maybe in assigning it. So I don't think you have to read anything over the summer. But we got at least as far as instruction. Hopefully you can feel the importance of this. And I'm going to sit around chit-chat. If you want to have another little snack before we go, we don't have to leave, but I'm going to draw the official discussion to a close. And we can talk about whatever we want to talk about.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been very good. Let's give ourselves a hand. Give ourselves a sitting ovation.